Hey everybody, this is Andy, aka Love Retro BTW, across Twitter, Instagram, and Twitch. I do a podcast every Saturday called Cafe BTW, a morning gaming podcast, a retrospective look at the wonderful world of retro gaming, from interviews to guests. Join us every Saturday, like a Saturday morning cartoon, starting at 8 a.m., 11 a.m. Eastern. Also, if you're on Twitter, please join the brand new retro gaming community, a place to share, connect, and show your love for the retro gaming community. All the links are down below. And remember, enjoy the Gamers Week podcast.
Coming up on Gamers Week podcast.
Because there's a whole different Street Fighter II story where we actually robbed a machine, but I'm not telling that one tonight.
Scandalous.
Well, I'll tell you, here's the takeaway from that story. We broke open the machine. The first thing I did was put credits on it. And my friend goes, dude.
Big picture, dude.
Well, in my head, I was like, oh, I think we're going to compete on Saturday. I better get some practice in. It was all about the glory. Part of the reason I know Atlanta is because I was at the first two E3s that were there.
Oh, yeah.
That's where I became a Foo Fighters fan, because the Foo Fighters played the Sony party that year, in 1996.
Wow, really?
Oh, the Sony party at E3 always has a Sony artist, and Foo Fighters were a Sony artist at that time.
What year did you say that was?
It was like 95, 96, something like that. They played the Sony party, which I was there for. Then they left that party, went to some other party for a different company, and just decided to start jamming in the middle of that party. So they were like, get our instruments. Let's start playing some songs, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, I became a total Foo Fighters fan. I mean, a couple years later here in LA, the guest was like Macy Gray, which I enjoyed, but I didn't become a fan.
All right. Welcome to Gamers Week podcast. Like the name says, we analyze the best, worst, and weirdest headlines of the past week in the video game industry. This is episode 50. Yes, the big 5-0. We are officially over the hill. And today is Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. And I am Ryan, aka Retro Game Brews. And tonight with me, I'm joined by my two awesome co-hosts, first of whose newest novel is celebrating its first week on the Penitentiary Times Top 100, the self-help smash hit, I Got Away With It, and So Can You, Blue Williams. Blue, how are you doing tonight?
I knew I'd be a published author someday.
There's only one copy in the prison library, and they're fighting for it.
It's written on toilet paper. It's fine.
I also have with me a gentleman whose recent bout with Nashville Hot Chicken resulted in an acid reflux reaction that was so hot it registered as a missile launch warning from NATO's satellite. Donnie G, how you doing tonight?
Both my throat and the other part are all clear. It's nice and calm and cool. We are a go for more Nashville Hot Chicken.
Love it. And tonight we are joined by Christopher Cross. He's a longtime game dev who has worked in the video game industry since 1996. Diablo, Medal of Honor, and Marvel Avengers are just a few titles on his resume. Christopher, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hey, thanks for having me. Sure. What do you guys want to know? I mean, I've been in the industry for close to 30 years now. Makes me feel old. I'm almost as old as your podcast has episodes. Basically, I came up in video games before there were fancy things like college courses.
Right.
And I used to work in a console shop and all that good stuff. Basically, back in my day, we did it this way. So I'll be bringing the... you guys think it's like that. It's really like this POV tonight.
Love it. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. We're super excited to have you on the show. But why don't we go ahead and jump into our reviews, reactions, and requests. So first up is from Kev Bayless. Thanks so much for sharing our song, A Video Gaming Christmas. Great show. You all have a great dynamic. Catch up with you all next time we are in the US. Kev, I could not agree more.
I would love it.
Yep. Next up from Colonel Falcon. Thanks, Gamers Week podcast. You are my top podcast on Spotify. Well, thank you, sir. Thank you so much for listening. And lastly, from the Mad Milkman, come on, guys. A500 is Amiga 500. I am disappointed. Although, to be fair, the main reason I know this is because I own one. I am sorry. I personally have failed you, Mr. Milkman. That is on me.
I told you were going to lose your retro card.
Yep. I'll hand it in. We'll shred it. It's over tonight.
And now, it's time for the
very important poem.
Wow, that was kind of startling.
Yes.
You know, I was listening to that voice, like my listening to my voice as that voice, and I would love to do the entire section of my reading as that voice.
I think that would be too much. I think that would be way too much.
Fine.
Every Monday on Twitter, we post our VIP.
Our very important poll. If you'd like to participate, follow us on Twitter at GamersWeekPC. Now, the question for this week was, what's your favorite finishing move in video gaming? Coming in at a low 4.7%, Joker's gunshot from the Mortal Kombat versus DC universe. Second place is Mega Man's Final Smash at 18.6%. And taking the top spot this week is Sub-Zero's Spine Grab with 48.1%. Now, some of you said other at 28.7%. So let's take a look at some of those comments from the poll. At Blarcade says, shooting a rocket launcher at just about every goopy monstrosity in the entire Resident Evil series. I didn't even think about that. Would that constitute a finishing move?
Technically, yeah, I guess.
I'll allow it. Those rocket launchers are worth their weight in gold.
Mm-hmm. Right? If the thing's not moving after you blast it, I'd say it's a finishing move. Giggity. At Westwell 6 says, Knights of the Round from Final Fantasy VII or Omnislash. At Dodongo Dude says, love the brutalities, just plain old beating to a pulp. At Mavericks Hanger says, Spartan kick in Assassin's Creed Odyssey. This is Sparta!
Yep.
And at Doongi Forever says, Killer Instinct Orchid Finisher for reasons. LOL, so 90s.
And for those of you who do not know, that's because she flashes you.
Exactly.
And you fall over.
You actually die of a heart attack. So taking a look at the poll question for this week, Ryan, what was your choice?
So I've got some criteria for what a finishing move is, for me at least. So a finishing move should either be extremely brutal or extremely funny. It should be something that requires you to put a few inputs in. So the Mortal Kombat, if you're over the pit and you do one of those big uppercuts, to me, that doesn't count. You got to put some effort into it. With that in mind, you know, the spine grab, of course, is probably one of the more iconic fatalities that you can do in Mortal Kombat. But at the time that Mortal Kombat came out, I was young and I was also just getting over watching Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and freaked out by that by quite a bit. So when Kano did it in Mortal Kombat the first time, it just brought back all those memories.
Kalima. You
know, right, Kalima. Exactly. So honestly, at that point, it became a favorite of mine because, you know, it was just so incredibly brutal and it had a, you know, nostalgic kick for me as well. So all the things that make up a really good finishing move, in my opinion.
Very good. Blue, what's your choice?
So I went with Sub-Zero's Spine Grab. I thought and thought and thought for a better one, but I really couldn't think of one that had as much visceral impact. Like, especially back in the 90s, the first time you saw that, you were like, holy crap. You felt like video games had entered a new era with like violence and blood and gore. And as soon as you saw one of the older kids at the arcade do it, you were racking your brains to try to figure out how they did it so you could do it too. And then I also remember that it was so often used in examples for when like parents and government and the media were trying to say how video games were rotting the youth, because look at, you can pull somebody's spine out. And we're like, but that's why we love it. It's so cool. So definitely for me, if I'm going to think of one single finishing move, it's going to be Sub-Zero ripping out somebody's spine.
Nice.
I agree. Chris, do you have a favorite finishing move?
For me, if we go by the criteria, there's a couple of here that aren't technically finishing moves in the Mortal Kombat way, right? Where it's done and you got to do the finishing move, but more like proto ults, right? Like the first time that I did like an ult in Samurai Showdown 2, but they end up being finishing moves because you don't really activate them until later in the game. And if you do it right, it should be the last thing, right?
Right.
So my favorite one from that, from Samurai Showdown 2, was Genjiro's like card uppercut throw.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yep.
Where it was like five cards, like he would throw like five Hanafuda cards and then like slash, 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 which was like amazing at the time, right? And then I was going to throw in like, oh, okay, I've got one that nobody's seen, which would be we got a bootleg copy of Thrill Kill. Which if anybody wants to Google it, was banned, right? It was a Virgin Interactive game that didn't make it. And it got banned because of its brutality. And one of the finishing moves in that, well, there was a guy on stilts and he basically would stomp your head, right? And so it was so brutal, but it's like itchy and scratchy violence, right? It's so over the top that you know, it was just so over the top that it was actually entertaining, right? So I would say that being able to have seen some of those ults or like finishing moves at the end of that were really fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
What was your pick, Donnie?
I had a tough time with this one. I mean, there are so many different fighting games out there. There are so many different moves that you can do. And it was a toss-up. It was a toss-up between the original Spine Grab from Sub-Zero. That was the very first fatality I ever learned. I sat there in the arcades whenever Mortal Kombat first came out. I watched all the older kids do it, all the quote-unquote adults, and watched their hand movements. And it was like, okay, it's forward, down, forward. And then this one, and it's like, oh my God, I did it. I did it. I'm a badass. And no one's looking at me. I'm like, okay. So it was Sub-Zero's Spine Grab. Another honorable mention would be Jax's head squish from Mortal Kombat 2, where he's got the bionic arms and he claps your head and it explodes in a nice ketchup sun shower. I really like that one. But Doomguy Forever, that's my other toss up, was Killer Instinct, the Orchid finisher. The first time I saw that, I was like, whoa, like, dude, like, can you like, are they going to turn the screen to where you can actually see them? Wow. Like what? Wait a second. What? Why are they all dying of a heart attack just for a pair of boobs? Like, I don't get it. I mean, teenage Donnie G really liked that. But as I got older, I'm just like, I don't get it. It's still very cool. Like you said, it's very 90s. So it's my toss up between that one and Sub-Zero Spine Grab.
Nice.
I think that a lot of times in the 90s, you didn't really need logic behind what you were doing. You just did it.
That reminds me of a game. Have you guys ever heard of Tattoo Assassins?
No.
I'm not sure.
It's an unreleased arcade game that they made, I think, back in 94. If memory serves me right, it was made by Data East. And the whole thing was that there were like hundreds of finishing moves in the game. And one of them, you're a girl who's an ice skater. And for your finishing move, you turn around, bend over, and fart a plume of green gas into...
What?
Yeah. And that to me is like quintessential 90s humor too.
Fartality.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, I thought I knew, like, I have an encyclopedic knowledge of arcade games from like, you know, 81 to like 99-ish, and this is totally new for me. Kudos, bravo! Like you get, yes. you get like I don't know what the prize is. I'll send you like some bubble gum or something. But it's like seriously, in the last like 30 years, has almost never been a game, especially this outrageous, that I didn't know something about. And I'm like, right. I thought the name sounded familiar, but I'm looking at the screenshots and I'm like, I've never seen any of this. Like, this is, I have to go get a ROM. Like, what is this? Must play.
A buddy of mine, DJ Tatsujin on Twitter, he was playing it on his Twitch channel. And I was like, what is this? So he sent me a link to some of the lore behind it. And it's interesting. It, like I said, it's somewhere around like 100 different finishing moves you can pull off. And the tattoos have to do with something. I don't know. But yeah, unfortunately, it was never released.
Needs to be played.
Definitely.
We all learned something tonight.
All right, so why don't we go ahead and shout out our patrons for the week.
We couldn't do what we do without the help of our gorgeous patrons. Here are the generous folks supporting Gamers Week on Patreon. And guess what? We have two new patrons to announce.
Woo!
A big thank you and welcome to Hybrid Divide and You Fall Before Me. They'll be joining Davey PGH, the Red Ox PDX family, including Shannon and Luke, Zach Huge Thanks, Rerun Gamer, Number One Blue Sick Voice Fan, Random Retro Dude, Princess Kitty Mew Mew, Rai Rai's Secret Best Friend, Mega Retro Man, Gamatroid, Emo-esque, Bill Tucker, Rye Bread's Number One Fan, Fruitcake's Number One Stan, Ducks with Thick Thighs, The Wizard of Zardoz, Clayman71, Great Sayaman81, BNT Zillaguy, Geek With That, Crunchy Kong, Sheriff Snacks, Frank Grande, JNL Game, Love Retro BTW, Steven Sand, Ramboski, Terry Kinnear, Ducks in Disguise, Jim and Colleen, and Games with Coffee. Yay! If you like what you hear today, and we really hope you do, please consider joining us on Patreon. Your support helps cover the cost of producing the show, as well as other cool stuff we'll be doing, like prizes and giveaways. You'll also gain access to our weekly patron-only bonus cast called Gamers Week Uncut, Patrons with Benefits. Visit patreon.com/gamersweek or follow the link in the show notes to learn more.
So let's go ahead and jump into our headlines for the week. Our headline segment is proudly sponsored by the Retro Game Club podcast. It's a fantastic family-friendly retro gaming podcast, and in each episode, Rob and Hugh pick two games to play and discuss, as well as news, interviews, and other topics. Right now, they want to hear from you, your memories of browsing holiday catalogs and magazines for gift ideas. Send your answers to email at retrogameclub.net or follow the link in the show notes.
Do they want us to specify exactly what holiday catalog and or magazine we were looking at? Because
I
tell you,
I think it's probably Sears.
Yeah, that's the one that was jumping to my mind, was the great big Sears catalog. You get out your crayon, you go to the toy section, and you just circle everything.
Yep. I tried looking at the catalog my dad had. He was trying to pick out a gift for my mom, and that scarred me for life.
It's the one that was under his bed that you weren't supposed
exactly,
to look at.
That I had to go searching for. Yeah.
That's what made Donnie the man he is today.
From IGN, Microsoft has made a 10-year commitment to bring Call of Duty to Nintendo consoles. Microsoft has officially entered into a 10-year commitment to bring Call of Duty to Nintendo consoles following its acquisition of Activision Blizzard. Xbox boss Phil Spencer shared the news on Twitter, alongside confirming that Microsoft will continue to offer Call of Duty titles on Steam after the deal has closed. The last time a mainline Call of Duty title was on a Nintendo console was 2013's Call of Duty Ghosts, which made its way to the Wii U. Since then, Nintendo owners have been left behind when it comes to one of the best-selling game franchises of all time. This news comes at a time when many eyes are on the Microsoft and Activision Blizzard deal, and when many are focused on what this merger means for the future of Call of Duty on PlayStation. Spencer has stated that Call of Duty will ship on PlayStation as long as there's a PlayStation to ship to. And reports have come out saying Microsoft has offered a similar 10-year deal to Sony to keep the franchise on the platform. Call of Duty is one of the hottest topics in Microsoft's proposed Activision Blizzard acquisition, as some worry it and other similar AAA titles will tip the scales if they are locked to one platform. Microsoft has disputed these claims, with many of its comments coming out publicly. We'll still trail Sony and Tencent in the market after the deal closes, and together, Activision and Xbox will benefit gamers and developers and make the industry more competitive, Microsoft spokesperson David Cuddy said. Does the Nintendo Switch really need Call of Duty?
Probably not, but I think this is a great, like, big middle finger to Sony.
Yeah, I don't think it has anything to do with whether Nintendo needs Call of Duty or whether it will even run on a Switch. It just has more to do with Microsoft saying, see, we're not going to keep it as an exclusive. We're not going to have a monopoly. We're going to make sure everybody can play Call of Duty, even more so than they do now.
So I read this story earlier today. I had like two or three different reactions. One, there's a developer somewhere that's like doing a fist pump because they get to do the port.
Right.
But there's also like a developer somewhere that's going like facepalm because they're like, oh my God, the Switch is like, you know, a 5-year-old Android. Like, how are we going to get the rope on there? Right. So it's like, and I don't mean that in a diminutive way. I just mean that, like, you know, Nintendo has gone for playability as opposed to like bleeding edge tech, right? So it's a great console. It's just not competitive in a modern, you know, chipset kind of a way, right?
Right, right.
This is totally a PR move from my PR.
Oh,
move.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody that's jonesing for Call of Duty on Switch, right?
No.
Like, if you want to play Call of Duty, you either already have a different console or, you know, you've got it on PC. It's crazy.
Right. And it's funny because what's the joke that everybody always makes about Call of Duty is how big the file size is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the Switch comes with 32 gigs of internal storage and Warzone 2 is almost twice that big.
Oh, yeah. Easily.
Yeah. Not only that, like Call of Duty since Modern Warfare 1, multiplayer is a separate executable than the single player. So it's essentially you kind of have to install two games on the Switch, right? And do some sort of like, I have no idea how this is going to work. It's just
cloud version.
Maybe.
I mean, that's how most companies have made their ports to Switch is they don't bother making ports. They just offer a cloud version.
Right. And in fact, Call of Duty Mobile, I think, is probably the thing that gets ported.
Oh.
Yeah, right. Wow.
I just mean as far as the tech. It'll probably be like down-resed assets or lower LOD assets from like the console games, but assembled on the mobile tech.
It's going to be Call of Duty modern Minecraft.
Yes, that's right. Somebody give me the red powder Switch.
So would this then be the same crossplay with the Nintendo consoles as with the PlayStation and Xbox and PC? Because it's from what you're saying, it sounds like they would just get their butts handed to them.
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't know. There's no reason. There's probably no real tech reason to do it. If they've got the walls, like, by the way, everything could be crossplay. Like, the Xbox team and the Sony team basically have to say like, hey, we want to do this from crossplay. And they essentially like broker a traffic deal. Right. Mm-hmm. And they generally don't do it because they are always at war with each other. But it's like, I think we're going to see more of that in the future as far as like, who cares? Just let everybody match make against everybody else. I don't know. I have so many more questions after this headline than I have answers.
And a 10-year commitment to it as well. That's an interesting thought. Because, you know, eventually, of course, there's going to be the next version of a console for Nintendo. So it makes you wonder, are they planning to beef up their tech even maybe just enough to keep up with Call of Duty?
I don't see that as being a priority for Nintendo
They don't need Call of Duty. So why boost up your tech just for one franchise?
Yeah.
And they'd have to allow chat. And that's not Nintendo's thing either.
Oh, totally not their thing. I don't think Nintendo has a legal team that could write the EULA for online interactions in Call of Duty.
No, they would just do it like they do with Mario Kart, where you just pick from a list of pre-approved statements like, not fair, I'm using tilt controls.
Not fair, noob tube.
right. Stupid rocket launcher.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, I said EULA, but I meant the end user license agreement. I just always say EULA.
We're down with the lingo.
We speak the lingo. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you never know. Never know. Like, I so much jargon in this industry. It's ridiculous. All right. You want me to read this one?
Yep.
All right. Do you want a pirate voice? Do you, or, you know,
whatever voice you're comfortable in, we'll take it.
Yeah, from Europe.
Wait, he gets to do a voice, but I don't?
You're here special, every Donnie. Week.
I'm not going to do a voice, but all right. From Eurogamer, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe gets custom items feature today in free update. No blue shells? All blue shells. Beautiful perpetual chaos can now be yours whenever you desire. Thanks to a free new Mario Kart 8 Deluxe update, enabling players to define exactly which items they want to appear in their games. As detailed in Nintendo's announcement tweet, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe's new custom item feature works with offline versus races as well as certain online modes, and gives players the abilities to either randomize items that'll be available in their races or to toggle specific items on or off. And yes, that means competitions can now be entirely item-free. Lame.
It's not Mario Kart without items. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's not Mario Kart. It's like... it's bumper cars.
Right.
Mario Kart 8 Deluxe's custom items update is out today on Switch and arrives alongside Wave 3 of the game's Booster Course Pass DLC, adding 8 more tracks: Mario Kart GBA's Boo Lake, 3DS's Rock Rock Mountain and Rainbow Road, DS's Peach Gardens, Wii's Maple Treeway, plus Mario Kart Tour's London Loop, Berlin Byways, and the appropriately festive Merry Mountain. Nintendo has 3 more waves of DLC tracks due over the next 12 months, adding a total of 48 additional tracks to Mario Kart 8 Deluxe's already sizable starting lineup. All right, you already heard my response to an item-free game. Like, I know that's a choice. Some people are going to do that, but those are like...
It's a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's like if you've got the troll gene. But my question from a dev POV is like, if you went item-free, what does that do to the rubber banding system, right? And so, do you guys know what a rubber banding system is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the items are part of that rubber banding system. Like, there's no accident that somebody gets the freaking blue shell, you know, at exactly the wrong time for whoever's in front, right?
Right.
Like, what is that going to do? Like, I want to see those, like, design docs. Who's balancing this? And, you know, how much sleep did they get? And how much hair do they have left from pulling it out, like, over the last 6 months? Because it's bonkers.
I will say that I will no longer have to suffer a green shell getting shot right up my butt from behind by blue if they took away the items.
Why you mad, bro?
Yeah.
I understand the red shell, but the green shell, being able to be precise with that thing, like that's a thing of beauty, and I freaking hate it.
Green shell sniper, baby.
Oh, mad props. So I'm a glory player. That's high on my list of like top 10 glory sort of moves, right?
Right.
Green shell sniper shot, Quake 2 hand grenade, like airburst. Like, you know, there's some high skill items on my list. That's one of them for sure.
Yeah. Make sure you clip it, post it online. Everybody can see.
Yeah.
I don't see myself using this very much. Now, there's, of course, certain items on here that I would love to see nerfed in Mario Kart 9. Like, for example, I freaking hate the boomerang. I hate the lightning. I hate the fireballs. I don't hate the blue shell, even though I'm the one who's always getting shot at.
What does that mean?
You know exactly what it means. But I have a begrudging respect for the blue shell. So... I guess in a perfect world, I would see a couple items disappear, but all in all, I think the Mario Kart experience is what it is. You got to take it all, whether you like it or not.
I agree. The items make it more fun. Yes, it can make it increasingly aggravating, especially when you get hit by a green shell and then you start to go fast again. All of a sudden, bam, you get hit by a red shell and you're like, oh, okay. And you start to go fast again. And guess what? There's a bomb that somebody dropped and you're exploding. And you go from like second all the way down to 10th, and that you just have to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of all blue shells only for one person, and that's my brother. He would love that.
Nobody would want to be in first.
That's the point. Is you sit, but the thing is, you sit in second. You're going to be a first eventually. So what do? Do you hit the brake and let the person keep going?
Yes,
it is the longest game of Mario Kart that's ever been played.
I seem to recall when we did the patron only game night with Mario Kart 8, and your brother having the wonderful idea that we should do bombs only.
Bombs on Baby Park as well.
Oh God, no, no! Yes.
But I see my brother loving all blue shells because that's like his favorite part of the game.
So he must perpetually be in last.
I didn't say that. I just insinuated it.
Fair enough.
All right, next up from the Hollywood Reporter, Toe Jam and Earl movie in the works from Amazon and Stephen Curry. 1992 video game Toe Jam and Earl is in the works as a feature film at Amazon Studios. Toe Jam and Earl, created by Mark Vorzanger and Greg Johnson, centers on two space alien rappers who come to the Earth seeking a cure for a disease eradicating their home planet, Rhythm, Funk, and Groove. The synopsis of the project continues. Earth, their legends tell them, is the paradise where the music that created the culture originated. Unfortunately for our heroes, not only do they wreck their ship, but they find that Earth is, well, not the haven they expected, but the music part was true. So begins their quest to find as much of the music as they can in the hopes of saving their planet, and maybe ours as well. Now, a cult classic, Toe Jam and Earl became a hit video game upon its release in 1991. With a soundtrack pulling heavily from jazz, funk, and hip-hop. It was followed by two sequels, Toe Jam and Earl in Panic on Funkatron and Toe Jam and Earl 3 Mission to Earth. Amos Vernon and Nunzio Randazzo, the writers behind Hotel Transylvania 4 and upcoming Disney Plus Super Fudge series, will pen the screenplay. Story Kitchen's Dimitri M. Johnson and Dan Jevons will produce with Unanimous Media's Stephen Curry and Eric Payton.
So I want to point out that I predicted this back in episode 36.
Did you really?
I did. Back when we were talking about they announced that Comic Zone and Space Channel 5 were getting their own movie adaptations. And we talked about, hey, which Sega game do you think should get a movie adaptation? I said, Toe Jam and Earl, what do I win?
I said...
I think you get to go to the studio and claim rights, more or less, right? You get to go there and be like, this was my idea.
Or she earned a guest spot on the show?
A guest spot would be awesome, right?
How about this? I don't want a guest spot, but I want to help write it because I'm nervous. I'll be honest, I don't know anything about Amos Vernon or Nunzio Randazzo. There's not a lot about Hotel Transylvania 4 that gives me hope, though.
So I like the first three.
I have a little insight into that because I know Dan Jevons.
Oh, really?
Oh, nice.
So I read this story, and for me, like, my response is, oh, good for you, Dan. Because, like, on its face, if it didn't have Dan on there, I would have been like, who came up with this? I'm not saying that Toe Jam and Earl isn't worthy of a movie. It's just, it's been a long time, right? So, like, on paper, greenlighting this would have been probably a hard sell, but the person that I see in that list of names that I know would go to the mat for this is probably Dan Jevons. Like, I would say that 90% of this is 100% willpower from him, right? And so I would say, like, the story treatment for this will probably, you know, erring on the side of leaving some room for politics and stuff. It's probably going to be pretty good. Or at least faithful to what we would expect from a Toe Jam and Earl movie.
I hope so.
So hopefully that gives us a little bit of comfort in it. But, you know, making anything in Hollywood is like 1,500 cooks and nobody can agree what to order on the lunchtime
pizza. Right.
So.
Right, yeah. And that's kind of my concern, is because Toe Jam and Earl is such a time capsule for that particular era. Mm-hmm. And then even when they came out with the new Toe Jam and Earl game just a year or two ago, they kind of tried to, like, capture the same magic, but also modernize it as well. And it just didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. Whatever it was that made it special was missing. And so I'm a little nervous about them bringing it to a big screen, trying to make it palatable for a wide worldwide audience, and having it still be recognizable as Toe Jam and Earl. Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, though, and I'm probably going to get added quite a bit at this one, but I've never understood the appeal, at least for the original Toe Jam and Earl game. I never got it.
At Retro Game Brew.
Taking away that card.
Card revoked. Yep. But one thing we could probably guarantee is that Chris Pratt will do one of the voices.
There
Oh, no!
I can just hear Chris Pratt now singing.
La, la, la.
Yeah.
I loved Toe Jam and Earl, and I loved the sequel, Panic on Funkatron. I didn't play the third one, and I didn't play the newer one that just came out. I still haven't yet. I wanted to. It's on the backlog. But I'm kind of in the same boat as Blue. As whenever I first saw it, I was like, great, a Toe Jam and Earl game. And it just doesn't have the magic that it once did.
Right.
And I really don't know what the storyline is going to be. I'm anxious to see what kind of story they can come up with and how it's going to be interesting and keep our attention, those classic retro gamers that really love this intellectual property.
We're not who they're making it for.
Well, okay. So if we're not, then who is? Who are they kids. Making it for? Because do kids know Toe Jam and Earl?
No, but they didn't know Sonic. It doesn't matter. The name gets the parents in the theater. Then the kids are the one who drive the sales.
I don't know. I really don't know. They're going to have to do something really creative with like the trailer to be able to warrant a kid like, oh, yeah, okay, that looks interesting. I might want to go see that.
Nah, they'll just make it computer animated and some celebrity voices, the same obnoxious humor you find in every other computer animated kids movie, and it'll be done deal or rake in gazillion dollars.
So that's the formula?
That's the formula.
All right. Well, then why aren't we millionaires right now?
Because we don't have a million or more dollars to start a project
right,
like this.
Because we don't know Chris Pratt.
We could.
That's right. He's the linchpin on all of these.
Right. We just got to get him to agree to voice a part in a movie, and then we'll be fine.
That's right. When he was 9 years old, we used to roll him into meetings. Knowing that he was the holy grail of getting things greenlit.
So what do you think, Chris?
Good.
Yeah, exactly. Can I have a sandwich now?
All right, so why don't we jump into our top three new releases for the week?
All right, first up is Choo Choo Charles out on PC. Navigate an open world island in an old train, upgrade it over time, and use it to fight an evil spider train named Charles. Go looting or complete missions to find scraps, which can be used to turn your train into a death machine on wheels. Help out settlers in return for high-powered weapons and other items vital to Charles' destruction. Complete the main questline and summon Charles to a mortal duel. If you've gained enough strength, firepower, and skill, Charles may finally meet his match. Next up is Chained Echoes, out on PS5, Xbox Series X and S, PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and PC. Take up your sword, channel your magic, or board your mech. Chained Echoes is a 16-bit style, turn-based RPG set in a fantasy world where dragons are as common as piloted mechanical suits. Follow a group of heroes as they explore a land filled to the brim with charming characters, fantastic landscapes, and vicious foes. Can you bring peace to a continent where war has been waged for generations and betrayal lurks around every corner? And finally, Dragon Quest Treasures is out on the Switch. Eric and his sister Mia live on a Viking longship, dreaming of the day they can explore the world in search of grand treasure. One night, they encounter a pair of otherworldly creatures, Porcus and Persula, and are whisked away to a mysterious place known as Draconia, a legendary land full of treasures just waiting to be discovered. The adventure Eric and Mia have always dreamed of is finally underway. So out of these three new releases, Chris, which one are you looking at?
Sorry, I was watching a video of Choo Choo Charles because that's the one I'm looking at. Because like, I'm so enthralled with this idea. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh my God, he's a solo developer. Like, I need to know more about this. Like, I'm really into this. Like, I can't play AAA games anymore. I have to play like indie stuff. AAA games are literally in my head. I'm going, okay, in about 3 seconds, I'm going to get a shotgun. All right. Here comes the betrayal. All right. It's so boring for me. Whereas like a Choo Choo Charles is so, thank you for introducing this to my life. I am going to check this out. And
you're welcome. It's super exciting. I saw that title on the new releases. I was like, is this for real? And so I was like, oh, hell yes, this is for real.
So I'm going to play Choo Choo Charles, and then I'm probably going to reach out to the developer and say, like, dude, I've got an idea for you.
Dude.
it's called Satan Stole My Internet. Let's do it.
Love it.
Let's go.
So what about you, Donnie? What are you playing?
I got to say Choo Choo Charles. I watched the trailer for this thing, and it looks like Thomas the Tank Engine started doing some bad drugs and getting into trouble and turned into a nightmare. And the fact that I get chills thinking about this thing crawling at me, and it doesn't stay on the damn track. That's the thing. It's a
freaking spider train.
Right.
That's what spider trains do.
It can go across all the terrain. It's like you're stuck on this train on this track, and here this damn thing comes. It can go left. It can go right. It can go above you. And I guess you've got this little turret thing on the back that you can shoot at him with. But not only that, there are other little things, characters in masks, in like clown masks or whatever, just like walking in front of you, walking by, and all of a sudden they stop and one looks at you, and I'm like, nope, 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 nope. That one's got my vote.
Okay, so this is a living nightmare. What about you, Ryan?
So 16-bit style, turn-based RPG set in a fantasy world where dragons are as common as piloted mech suits. Oh! It's like all the things I want. Check, 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 check.
Yep, the fine print says made for Ryan.
But I will say, Pennywise the Train does sound very interesting. So, Blue, what about you?
Chained Echo sounds interesting and it looks beautiful, but yeah, I'm going to go with you guys. I'm all in for Choo Choo Charles. This game sounds bonkers. It looks terrifying. And where else are you going to fight a spider train? Nowhere else. So yeah, I'm in for Choo Choo Charles.
Yeah, I'm back.
Welcome back.
Yeah.
Well, during Medal of Honor, we had so many different German accents that we used to walk around doing.
All right. So before we move on, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor. This segment is proudly sponsored by The Leetest Podcast. It's a show where three friends and occasional guests play games about video games, including trivia games, game show games, and more. Here's this week's trivia question. In 1971, when the name Grindelman Industries was misheard on a phone call, no one could have suspected that 5 years later, Gremlin Industries would create the first game in what niche game genre named after an animal? Tune into the Leetest Podcast this Wednesday to hear the answer. You can find the Leetest on your favorite podcast platform, and we'll also have their links in the show notes. So guys, what genre?
I know the answer, but I do want to come out and just say that was a bit of serendipity because Gremlin Industries is so much a better name than Grindelman. Grindelman sounds like a friggin' like a law office.
Welcome to Grindelman and Grindelman.
Right.
Vandalay Industries.
Vandalay, nice.
So it's a game genre after an animal?
Mm-hmm.
Redacted. Just imagining this going redacted.
I honestly have no clue. I don't know.
Do you have a guess, Chris?
I mean, I don't, but hold on. I'm going to do some like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and talk it through a little bit. So 71
like
plus 5 years is 1976. So it's not going to be like what we would consider like a core video game sort of producer, right? So the genre would be like, I mean, 76, we're talking like mainframe games, board games, card games, you know, and like backyard games, you know what I mean? And so I'm trying to like rack my brain. Gremlin Industries sounds so familiar. I don't know. I really can't. I can't come up with a genre named after an animal.
It's redacted.
What? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I see that. So basically would have been the first
redacted.
Something like that. Yeah.
That's a genre.
Yeah.
That's
the first genre. Game is called
redacted. I what hate the? Those games. Yep. I find them way too stressful and irritating, but it's a genre.
Wow.
All right. So for our main topic tonight, what we plan to do is actually spend some time here having a discussion with Chris to get a chance to understand a little bit more about his history and kind of his contributions to gaming history as well. So sit back, enjoy. We're going to ask Chris some questions and hopefully you enjoy it here for tonight. All right, Chris, so why don't we start off with kind of the first question, which is how did you become a gamer? Did you start playing games as a kid? And what were your go-to games?
So, you know, I like this question because most people ask you how you got into the industry, right? But the prep for that was the fact that I was a gamer, right? And especially back then, you got a lot of cred for your game knowledge, right? And so for me, it all started essentially with a Cocktail Miss Pac-Man machine and a 2600, right? Like those are probably my first two game experiences that I don't know. It just hits your brain different when you're a gamer, right? Like the endorphin is so much stronger than almost anything else. And like, you know, I would be like, oh my God, I got to finish this League of Legends game so I can go home and play video games. it was a major motivator for time mismanagement. But yeah, I was an arcade rat growing up. Like we can drive around Southern California and I can not only tell you where an arcade used to be, but what game I first played there.
Wow.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that's a heck of a memory.
So you can say like Dragon's Lair and I'll say Castle Park, Manhattan Beach. Right. And I could tell you where the machine was. Like I could walk the floor and be like, oh, this is where Mr. Flea's Adventure was. This is where Mr. Dew's Wild Ride was. This is where Distrotron was. And it was the good Distrotron. It's the one with the butt ledge.
Yep. I know what you're talking about.
That's the good one. The regular cabinet sucks. Like you need the butt ledge. There was a bowling alley. Like I knew every arcade from the Huntington Beach Pier to probably almost to Santa Monica. With like the far outlier of like UCLA and the Pac-Man arcade in Pasadena.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, there was an arcade in Pasadena called Pac-Man. It was called Pac-Man Arcade.
Like, what games did they have there?
Yeah.
Besides Pac-Man, I don't know. Actually, there was a huge Street Fighter II tournament out there in like 1992 that I missed because I didn't have a car.
Oh.
Because I was a huge Street Fighter II player. I got busted for the quarter and string trick in an arcade. Because I was practicing Street Fighter 2.
I didn't know that actually worked. That's funny. Well,
it doesn't work how you think it works. You get a quarter, you tape dental floss, one string, but you wrap it so that it's both sides, right? So if you think of like the dental floss in a J shape, the quarter sits in the J, right? So that basically it's supporting the weight. Then you scotch tape both sides. And then from the middle of the quarter, you hold it at the coin return slot, and then you measure the floss up until up to the coin drop slot. And that's the distance that you're looking for, right? And the trick is when it falls, it turns 90 degrees, so you can't pull it out. So what you're actually trying to do is just activate the dip switch.
Yes.
And so you jiggle, let some line loose, jiggle, let some line loose, jiggle, let some line loose until you start getting credits when you jiggle, right? And then at that distance, you tape it to the machine and you flick the string anytime you want to add credits. And then then when somebody comes by and they're going to bust you, you just pull the string out. So it's more like a BOGO than it is like a return on your quarter.
That's awesome.
I also know how much money is actually was in a coin box back then. And it was $700.
Wow.
Dang.
So, yeah. So when you had a machine come by and empty the coin box, like when the admin came through and you were in an arcade with seven Street Fighter machines that all needed to be empty at 4 PM, they were making upwards to like, you know, $1,400 a day per machine.
Wow.
How much does $700 in quarters weigh?
It's heavy. It's close to like 10 to 15 pounds.
It's not going to throw your back out.
No. Because there's a whole different Street Fighter 2 story where we actually robbed a machine, but I'm not telling that one tonight.
Scandalous.
Well, I'll tell you, here's the takeaway from that story. We broke open the machine. The first thing I did was put credits on it. And my friend goes, dude.
Big picture, dude.
Well, in my head, I was like, oh, I think we're going to compete on Saturday. I better get some practice in. It was all about the glory. Needless to say, it was free snacks from the vending machine for months after that.
Right.
So anyway, basically, I played so many video games, and this is a segue into my career, that basically within a 5-week period, 4 friends stopped me mid-sentence and quote unquote, dude, I have no idea what you're talking about. You need to go make video games for a living. Like the first time somebody says that, especially in the 90s, you're like, yeah, whatever, man. That's not even, how do you even get that job? By the time the fourth friend said, you need to go do this, I was like, oh, I guess I need to start figuring this out.
Well, that's kind of funny because you said it's, you know, back in the 90s, it was basically your love of video games that propelled you to that. Now it seems like it's more difficult to get into that industry than it was back
in the day. I would say the barrier of entry has changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked in a console shop in Westwood, like the 2 years before I went into video games. And I was basically paid in like sandwiches and like soda pops. And
nice.
A guy that was making kids games for kids with diabetes to teach them how to do their insulin was actually working for EA, and he was out in the valley, and I showed him Dune 2 Building of a Dynasty, and I started talking to him about it. And by the way, working in a console shop was great, right? Because I essentially was pitching games to people all day long. Like, Mickey's Magic Castle, you're going to love this. Like, you know, like basically I got the practice there. And this guy goes, if you can make it to the valley, remember, I don't have a car. If you can make it to the valley at this time, like whatever, Thursday, I'll intern you. And I was like, oh my God, a video game job. Like, I didn't even really know what that meant. And basically I was like, I can't get out there. Right. And also he was kind of a like crabby son of a anyway. So but there was something there already for me.
Right.
I basically vacuum salesman my way into my first test gig.
Vacuum salesman is a verb.
Yes, it is. Absolutely. I did the vacuum salesman. Like I basically got my foot in the door and sold my way into my first job. Once my friends convinced me, there was no stopping me. Like I sent my resume to 3 places. It's laughable what was on that resume. And then but I had it in my head. If I can get you on the phone or get an in-person interview, I'm getting hired. Right.
Right. You could sell it.
I can sell it. I basically talked my way into getting a test gig on Warcraft 2 language ports and then the Warcraft 2 expansion. And after that, the next part of my career started, the early years.
So you spent 8 years working for Electronic Arts, a notoriously controversial company.
Yep.
What are some of the games you worked on? And are there any particular memorable stories from your time at EA?
So let me bookend this a little bit because it wasn't working directly for EA. The company I worked for was DreamWorks Interactive. At DreamWorks Interactive is where I got my first design gig on a game called Small Soldiers Squad Commander, which was like an RTS for kids. And then the lead designer for Medal of Honor at the time was moving on to other things. And they're like, hey, Chris, can you finish out the design and then, you know, go down and help them out for a little bit. After a couple of weeks, I went back up to the GM and I said, you actually intended for me to stay on this project for the rest of the time, right?
You got me.
Yeah, exactly. You got me. And he looked at me and went, smart kid. So EA bought us right when Medal of Honor was shipping. Basically, everybody at DreamWorks Interactive now got bought by EA, right?
Right.
When I was there, that was when EA Spouse happened. And EA Spouse, for those that don't know, was basically we were working so many hours that somebody's wife wrote an open letter that was like, this has to stop. This is unhealthy. I don't see my husband, blah, 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 et cetera. It was like, it was a huge thing in like 1999 or 2000, something like that. Wow. And so it was interesting because, you know, it's working for the man. Like, I got into making video games because I wanted to make my own video games, right? And at that time, if you weren't pitching them something like either a license makeover or some sort of genre killer, there was no getting a pitch through anything, right? So basically, like, it was creatively unfulfilling for me because I'm like, oh my God, I've been working on this World War II shooter for like 8 years. This is not the World War II game I would make anymore.
World War II shooters are Donnie's favorite.
Oh, are they?
God. No, no, they're not. No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's very heavy sarcasm.
Okay, got it.
I liked them back in the day whenever they were the thing. You know, it's like, okay, that's what everybody was doing. It was World War II shooter, World War II shooter, World War II shooter. And then Call of Duty came out. And, you know, Call of Duty initially was the World War II thing over and over and over again. And then Modern Warfare hit. And it just like, I was like, okay, I never looked back. I never wanted to go back and revisit another World War II game ever whatsoever. But I did play Sniper Elite.
I have one more World War II game in me, but it's not a shooter.
It's a card-based puzzle game.
That is correct. Yeah, it's like Fairway Solitaire with Nazis.
I'm in.
No, I have one more, and it's more of a narrative based game, and it would be my anti-war war game. I've got that one loaded in the hopper. I got like 20 games loaded in the hopper. When you work in games this long, like, I've got a Space Cthulhu game that'll blow your mind. Like, it's gonna be amazing.
I'm already blown.
Right.
But then I'm trying to think of if there are any other memorable stories from while I was there. It is a treasure trove. How do I say this? When you look at game companies that have been around for a long time and you sort of run into their problems or foibles, right? Of like, you know, this seems to be where they always stumble. EA, you have to remember, Madden by itself paid for all of the rest of the games.
Right. Of course.
So literally, you could just throw money at every single other game at EA at the time and just burn it. And Madden not only paid for it, but you know, the margin was big enough that they still made a profit. So they were a little bit more risky, but also as the margins got thinner, Madden was an annual game, right? So you sort of have this Uber master of the shareholders. You're not necessarily making games to be great. You're making games to appease the shareholders, right?
Right.
And yes, that's through sales, and arguably sales happen for good games, but that's not the methodology. So the annualization of, or attempt to annualize everything, was a big incentive or a big initiative in like the early 2000s. And they kept coming to me like, how do we do this every year? And I was like, well, you get two teams and you hopscotch them like Activision is doing. But why would you do that? Because I don't think the market can sustain that for that long. Apparently, Call of Duty proves me wrong. But at the time, I was like, people need time to breathe. Don't put out a new war game every year, right? Like, that's not sustainable. But even Activision, they don't have two teams working on anymore. It's like three or four that are all working on Call of Duty that are all staggered. So Treyarch does a game in 3 years. Sledgehammer does a game, it takes 3 years, and they just pass the baton every time, right?
Right.
It's bonkers.
And even they just announced that they're not going to do annual releases anymore.
Right. It's the overhead is so high now, and I don't know if the margins are big enough, even though they're not covering cost of goods anymore to do physical. It's basically like the console market isn't flat, but it's not growing like it did in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's oversaturated?
You know, I think the whole games industry is oversaturated. It is so hard to discover something new or fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I used to pride myself in not only my encyclopedic knowledge for games, but what was coming out every year. That ended in like 2006, where I was like, I can't keep up. I was on the Academy panel for Story and Games, and I would get a box of games at the end of every year. One year, they all showed up, and I was like, I don't know 80% of these. And that was, you know, 2007, 2008, something like that. Now, you know, there's something like, 1,000 new games on the Apple App Store every 10 minutes or something like that.
Jeez.
Like the saturation is ridiculous. So how do you even, like the business is so different now than it was 10 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, the barrier for entry for just a normal person to come out and make their own game and release it on the marketplace, it's very little.
Yeah, there's almost zero resistance in the wall to get to release, right?
Right.
So when YouTube first came out, I was like, oh, who's going to upload videos of themselves? And then I, you know, after a few years, I go, oh, wow, YouTube's really awesome because there are people that are getting opportunities now that they wouldn't have gotten before, right?
Right. Right.
But it's not even an 80-20 rule. It's like a 97-3 rule. There's 97% crap. Right. And mm-hmm. like 3% good. But the problem is that 97% is in the order of magnitude of hundreds of thousands of videos. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. Finding that 3% of really great or good stuff is extremely difficult. So the barrier to success for games now is no longer the skill to make it like it used to be. It's now marketing, PR, exposure.
A skill to get it discovered.
It's discovery, right?
Right.
Like in my old man-ish days, I was very privileged to be in the game industry when I was and still am. But like in those years, I somehow cultivated skill in a industry that essentially had a skill barrier. I was super fortunate for that. However, I think if I had been born maybe 10 or 15 years later, I would have ended up becoming a Twitch streamer, right?
Right.
Because my love of playing games came first, not the puzzle solving of how to make one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty good segue to our next question. Like you were kind of just pointing out, for those of us who grew up gaming in the 80s and 90s, today's video games are almost unrecognizable. There's battle royales, there's free to play, there's microtransactions, there's mobile games. What, in your opinion, is the worst gaming trend that's popped up in the last several years? And is there another trend that you actually really like?
So this is a tough one. Like when microtransactions first showed up, my brain went to, oh, actually, this is kind of like an 80s arcade right now. Mm-hmm. You're paying to extend your time. Now, anybody that says that, you know, monetization is evil doesn't really understand how arcade games were made. Arcade games were monetization machines. They tuned the game to quarter drops. So how often they could get you to put a quarter in, right?
Right.
But the increment that they used for measuring was 15 seconds. So it was 15-second quarter drop increments. So your first quarter would last you like a minute. And then 30 seconds, and then 15 seconds. And then on, it was just an increment of how many 15-second intervals until the next quarter. It's kind of like when you play Pac-Man and you get to the third stage, and then it all of a sudden gets harder, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's not just to challenge you. That was, hey, if you're not good, you're going to have to drop another quarter. And so like monetization was hyper-intentional in those days. And people forget that because it was so skill-based. That part of the challenge was, I've got a couple dollars and quarters. How long can I stay, you know, in the arcade? So when free to play first came out, I was not resistant because I saw it as just a different monetization. Now, what, you know, the spreadsheet game designers have done is basically ruined free to play for everybody.
Right.
Right. Like as a, for instance, oh my God, I almost threw my phone. So Plants vs. Zombies 2.
Like right. Post- I know exactly what you're talking about. If you right? don't pay for the extra stuff, you can't get through the game.
Right. They stop progression. This is a double-edged sword. And so here's the TLDR on this question, which is, I love hate Battle Pass. So Battle Pass is a predetermined gachapon with like no wrapper. So you can see the progression. So it feels fair. But the thing is all they did was roll out or do 50 RNGs. Like there's no freedom of actual choice there. They're just enticing you with carrots.
Right.
Right. And so like the hate part of this is as a designer, I see the trick. As a player, I'm like, oh yeah, this makes sense. Yeah, the more XP I get, like the more stuff I get. Like, that's great. Right. It's like monthly progression. I got it. Right. So it is technically probably one of the fairest, you know, monetization schemes. But as a game designer, I can't help but think there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way.
Right.
Like, this is a great system. I love it. Mechanically, it's gorgeous. But like from a pure gamer at heart standpoint, I feel like I am playing it your way. I'm looped into the stuff that you're deciding to give me. And it bothers the sort of pure game designer in my heart.
Right. Which kind of brings me to our next question a little bit, because this is another thing I think that we're trying to inject into the gaming industry without necessarily thinking about maybe the end results or the user and or end user experience for that. But, you know, despite some of the pushback you've seen from gamers, many video game companies are continuing to work for the inclusion of NFTs and blockchains in games. So we were curious, you know, where do you see this heading in say the next 5 to 10 years?
So NFT as a technology and blockchain as a technology are not inherently bad.
Right.
The technology is agnostic to your morals. It's how people have been using it. 1,500 different colored versions of primate and sunglasses is like fine, but that's not the real purpose of the technology, right? Now, if you think of the blockchain as a ledger and NFTs as a digital representation of like a location on the blockchain, there are lots of really cool things you can do with this. So I have a project that I'm trying to pitch called LFG. And it's either let's f-ing go or looking for game, right? And one of my problems in games is I'm older. All my friends are older. We don't play games anymore. So there are whole sets of games that I won't play because I don't have buddies to play with. Because some games are just more fun that way. Like, I'm probably not going to play much Overwatch 2. Like, I just don't want to play with a bunch of randos, right? So my solution is qualitative matchmaking, where it's essentially match.com for gamers based on your play habits, right?
So match.com for gamers, gets angry, calls his squad, noobs, shouts out racist epithets, looking for group.
That's right. But they go to Prisoner Island. And they can talk, you know, we'll match them with other like personalities. And then the person who always plays support in League and also plays like Zenyatta in Overwatch gets matched with, you know, an AD carry. It's not just about the roles. It's a little bit about personality. This is the flip that NFTs makes possible. You get an NFT for your account and it's you. Nobody else gets it. It's your NFT. And it's only yours. That NFT basically is the storage for all of your matchmaking data. What makes this awesome is you could do a matchmaking system that doesn't keep your data, that you white label to all the publishers, and then the players bring themselves to every game stored on their NFT. So basically, your privacy is guaranteed because nobody has access to that NFT except for you and whatever contract you have with the game that you're playing. This, to me, is a fantastic use for a blockchain technology, which is everybody gets their own section of the blockchain. You can store your own private information there, and then you can release only the private information that you want a game company to use to make your game better. As opposed to probably the like 1 gig of information that Activision has on me from playing all of the Call of Duty games, which I'll never touch or see or even know what it is.
Right.
Yeah. It's yours, but it's not yours.
Yeah. Game data is really creepy. Like when I worked at Nexon, we could, without seeing a person's name, location, or any other personal data, I could look at their gameplay habits and tell you generally what part of the country they lived in. Like I can make a lot of assumptions based off of their play habits. It's really crazy. Well, here, I'll give you, for instance, only plays Friday through Sunday afternoon, spends $25 to $30 a month, and will pop in during the day, the rest of the days, right? That's usually a professional, somebody who has a day job, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Probably around 30, depending on what times they're logging in, I can tell you what part of the country they're in. Like, basically, you can do all of this inferred data by looking at somebody's account, and it's purely game data.
Interesting.
It's like, if you get good at it, it's totally like that scene in The Matrix where that guy's like looking at the code and he goes like, oh, like check out this blonde right here, blah, blah, blah. Like I could be like 25 to 35, like male, Topeka, like, you know.
Topeka?
Yeah, Topeka, probably, you know, by the amount of money they're spending has like, probably makes about 90 grand a year, something like that.
Wow.
So NFTs, blockchain, technology, good. I haven't seen a use for it yet that anybody has really leveraged it in a way that is beneficial to people. Although, full disclosure, I was working with a company called Pocket Full of Quarters, and they have a stablecoin. They have the right idea. It's a very specific use, but basically it's a transferable stablecoin so that, like, you're not locked into one game, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can buy quarters in one game and then go spend them in another game.
That's nice. Yeah.
To do that, you have to get developers, like, it's chicken and the egg, right? You have to get the game so you can get the players, but you need the players so you can get the games.
Right. All right. Well, let's wrap up this interview by letting people know where they can find you online in case they want to connect and hear more of your stories.
Oh, I'm a ghost.
Okay.
No, I'm nowhere and everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. I'm watching you. So Coffee with Cross is actually a great way to find me. But if you want to ever see me playing video games, look for Jim Tarver.
Okay.
Jim Carver, you said?
Tarver. T-A-R-V-E-R.
Got it.
Yeah. Jim Tarver. So it's the most generic American name I could come up with. But
all right.
Like Coffee with Cross, like when I did that, I branded everything. My Twitter is Coffee with Cross. My YouTube is Coffee with Cross. Like basically, if you do Coffee with Cross, you will probably find lots of ways to get a hold of me.
All right. We will have his links in the show notes if you don't want to look up Coffee with Cross.
Awesome.
All right. So why don't we go ahead and wrap up tonight's episode. Thank you for listening to episode 50 of Gamers Week podcast. And a big thank you to the Retro Game Club podcast, the Elitist podcast, and Love Retro BTW for sponsoring this episode. And don't forget to check out their links in the show notes. And a big thank you to you, Chris, for coming on today's episode. We really do appreciate it.
Hey, absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
So if you want to connect with Gamers Week, follow us on Twitter at Gamers Week PC, email us at gamersweekpodcast@gmail.com, visit our merch store at gamers-week-podcast.creatorshutup.spring.com, or if you want to do it the easy way, follow the links in the show notes, and of course, join us on Patreon at patreon.com/gamersweek. And finally, since you made it all the way to the end of the episode, please leave us a rating and review to let us know how we did. We really do value your feedback, and while you're there, consider subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or your podcast platform of choice. Thank you, everybody, and have a great night.
So long, farewell, Avita saying goodbye.
So long, farewell.
Avita saying goodbye. To you and you.
Who knew Chris was a soprano?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, too funny.
Good night.
That's funny.
Yeah, good night.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut.
Welcome to Gamers Week Uncut, patrons with benefits. This is the unscripted, patron-only bonus cast with less editing and more dirty jokes. We don't know where the conversation will go, but we're sure it will be weird.
This fish just went right on my nipple, and I'm just like...
I Google Street Fighter 6. The first search result that comes up is people think they can see Ryu's dick in the Street Fighter 6 reveal.
Listen up here, kids. You're not going to want to get one of those VDSTDs things, right? Make your fall off. When you go, grab a pro. You'll be doing it for America.
That was perfect.
If you want to hear weekly episodes of our patron-only bonus cast, join us at patreon.com/gamersweek.